morning. Yashikoach again to Torah in Motion for running this conference and running the learning. And it's wonderful to see everybody. And we're intimate here, so please feel free to ask questions. Please feel free to interrupt. This is not going to be as formal a session as some other talks in the past. So I'd like to share a little bit of personal vignette and then start talking about what I'd like to share with you this morning. This is not obviously an exhaustive discussion, etc. So I went to a yeshiva high school called MTA, which is a very well-known, I don't know if it's called MTA anymore, yeshiva high school in New York. And I was a very good student. I had a wonderful, I had wonderful teachers. What?
I wasn't.
Oh, okay. So I was a goody-goody. Right. Right. Keep sharing, you know. So I was a very good student in Gemara and in most of my subjects, and I hated my Chumash class. Why did I hate my Chumash class? I hated my Chumash class because it was the most painful class in the world. The Rebbe, who wasn't really an expert in Chumash, would basically read a pasuk and say, you know, these three mefarshim say this. And then he would read another pasuk and say, these four mefarshim say this. And there was no engagement with the students. There was no interest in broader questions. There was nothing. And it was like tearing your hair out. The only saving grace was, I don't know if any of you have ever lived in New York City, but there's a thing called alternate side of parking. I don't know if you know what that is. You have to move your car because of, whatchamacallit, because of the street cleaners every Monday and Thursday, or every Tuesday and Friday. So this Rebbe, in the middle of class, would have to leave to move his car. He would have like one eye on the car, not to get a ticket, and he would have one eye on the Chumash. So the saving grace was he would take about, you know, 15, 20 minutes, where he would give us chavrusa, which was basically batala, you know, basically waste time, until he came back. So that was the saving grace. But the real saving grace for me as a high school student was the fact that I davened in a very wonderful synagogue called Lincoln Square Synagogue, which was led by Rabbi Shlomo Riskin. And there was a young man named Rabbi David Silber who was very into Tanakh. He wasn't yet famous. He hadn't yet started any institutions. And he was a single young man, a smicha student or something else. He was past smicha. And he would give a shiur on Shabbat, which was like mind-opening. He would talk about the characters in the Tanakh. He would talk about these broad, big questions, and this was fascinating. And Rabbi Riskin also would give wonderful drashot, and from time to time, he would quote from his teacher, Professor Nechama Leibovitz. So I was 15 years old. I didn't know who Nechama Leibovitz was. But it was very fascinating, because whenever he would quote her, it was always very interesting. It was always very engaging. And so I started to explore. I asked Rabbi Riskin who Rabbi Nechama Leibovitz was, because we never heard about her at MTA. You know, this Rebbe had never heard of Nechama Leibovitz, you know. And so actually, I started reading everything I could get my hands on from Nechama Leibovitz, and I was very enthralled. And I became, you know, as a kid, I started reading, and when I went to Israel, for my Shana Aleph in Israel, I went to hear her sometimes, and I read more, and I read more. And it was tremendous in terms of expanding and exposing myself and many, many others to the seriousness of Tanakh study. All of a sudden, just like Gemara could be studied very rigorously with a method and with a methodology, as I got older, I recognized what she was really teaching was that just like Gemara can be studied very rigorously and taught, and you can teach kids and adults how to become independent learners, so too with Tanakh. And one of her, and you know, Nechama Zichrona Livracha, I think one of the first programs I spoke at here at Torah Motion was in 1997, right after she passed away. Jay asked me to give a hesped describing Nechama. So for me, it's a kind of closing of a circle, you know, 12, 15 years later, to talk today about a loving critique of aspects of the methodology of Nechama Levitz, Zichrona Livracha. Because, as I often believe she taught us, and as I believe a person should be, a person, when they learn from a Rebbe, has to be careful not to become only to become a chassid. A person is supposed to be a Talmud and not a chassid. And the difference between a Talmud and a chassid is, of course, the ability not to lose your own personality and to be able to evaluate critically aspects of what you learn, so that you don't, God forbid, become a blind follower without recognizing some of the costs and benefits of certain methodologies. So this morning, I'm going to quickly talk about elements which were so wonderful in her shita, but I want to spend the bulk of my remarks engaging in a loving critique of aspects of Nechama's shita as I understand them, and as I've seen them play out in classrooms. I've been in chinuch since 1987, teaching in classrooms, and I've had my chance to see a lot of classes, a lot of tests, a lot of worksheets of different teachers. So I'd like to share with you some of my thoughts and feelings, and then you can please chime in and disagree, agree, argue vigorously, argue not so vigorously, whatever you want to do. So I think, as I mentioned before, one of the greatest things Nechama did for the study of Tanakh was she elevated the study of Tanakh and Mefarshim, the study of Torah and Mefarshim especially, to a serious place. Serious place in the sense that it's not just slop-plop. You come in and say vortlach, like some people do, or you simply read a verse and then translate, and read a verse and translate, which is extremely boring. But she turned the study of Tanakh into, and the study of Chumash, especially, into a very rigorous methodological approach. This is a tremendous contribution to the world of the study of Chumash and Parshanim in the Dati world, Dati Tzioni world, especially in Israel, and of course afterwards it had impact on America and Europe and many other places in the world through her sheets that people started to use in the classroom and people started to use in colleges, etc. And not only in the Dati world, but one of the things that Nechama did is that she legitimized traditional Parshanut as a rigorous area of study in the world of the academic world in Israel. Meaning, until Nechama came on the scene, basically, you had the study of Chumash in the non-religious world was basically controlled by biblical criticism. And that was the extent of, in the 30s and 40s, what people at Hebrew University and Tel Aviv University and other universities studied. They either studied philology, you know, figuring out the roots and figuring out the linguistics and the history of words, or they studied hardcore biblical criticism. But nobody studied rigorously the world of Parshanut HaMikra, the world of Jewish exegesis, as a legitimate enterprise in terms of trying to understand the biblical text. Nechama elevated the Jewish enterprise of 800-900 years of serious Parshanut HaMikra since the time of Rav Saadia Gaon to a very important, significant, legitimate place within the world of the academy. And that's not anything to sneeze at. She created a whole field, if you can use that term, of the study of Parshanut HaMikra as an intellectual study, as intellectual history, as integrated with Tanakh. And she had many, many students, many of whom went on to do their own thing, but became leaders within the world of academic Bible in Israel in the 60s and 70s and 80s and beyond. She also introduced, in not in a full-fledged way, and that's one can, and that's what I'll talk about a little bit later, but she also introduced Israelis and Americans and Europeans to the literary method that was starting to be developed by what she called the New Criticism, which was her term to contrast to Bible criticism, which she hated with passion. But the New Criticism, which focused on a close reading of the biblical text, which in a certain sense was much closer to the Midrashic approach. The Midrashic approach, as it's been called, which sees omni-significance in every single word of the Bible,
is much closer to the literary method today, which looks for change in terminology, change in gender, change in nomenclature, and makes a big deal out of that, what we call close reading, kriyat smuda in Hebrew. And that was something that Nechama also started to popularize within religious circles, and that became the platform upon which many of her students and others really took off and really developed it. So people like Professor Uriel Simon and Professor Yair Zakovich and many others ran with those first nitzanim, those first blossoms, and created a whole field, which today is burgeoning. And so she also, to my mind, gets a little bit of the zchut ha-bechora for introducing people to people like Meir Weiss, who she considered a Rebbe. Meir Weiss, who was a German Jew who made Aliyah, who was one of the first to introduce literary study into the Bible in Jewish circles as an alternative to biblical criticism as the focus of one's energies. And she, tipin, as we say in the Gemara, slowly, from time to time, she would emphasize that. And she brought in those kinds of things, and as well as, of course, others who were doing stuff like that, like Martin Buber and Kasuto and Benno Jacob from Germany. She brought in these scholars, some of them who were religious, some of them who were not religious, and she got flack for that in certain circles, and therefore she wasn't taught in circles. But she was a very big proponent of Kabbalat Ha'emet Mimisha Amaro, take truth from wherever you receive it, even if that person was not religious. And she knew many of these people from Germany. She knew Benno Jacob. She knew Martin Buber. And yet she understood that they were contributing a tremendous amount to the study of Tanakh. And therefore, the area of literary analysis of the Bible, which is so popular today, to a certain extent, merits bringing that into the discussion. So the study of Parshanut as a serious enterprise with methodology. Number two, the contribution of legitimating it within the world of the academy. The introduction of literary study into the study of the Bible within religious circles. These are all wonderful contributions in terms of content and methodology. In addition, she, more than anyone else, taught the importance for teachers not only to simply lecture frontally, but she was the advocate par excellence of what's called today active learning. That you can't have students just sitting there listening to you, that you have to give them tasks. You have to give them issues. Every 10 minutes they should be writing and lurking. And don't have them, as she used to say over and over again, simply answer informative questions. What did Yaakov do? Yaakov left Charan, and he went, who cares? Let them use their mind and be engaged to go beyond something that they can say, or as she used to cynically sometimes say, Lama atem tzrichim lagid ba'ivrit ha'klokelet shelachem ma shekatuv ba'torah ba'ivrit kol kach yafa. Right? Why do you have to say in horrible Hebrew paraphrase something which it says so beautifully in the Tanakh? That's not what I need from a student. I want to see if they have havana, and if they understand, and if they can extrapolate, compare, contrast, do this topic, do that topic. And this was a major contribution that she made. She transformed the pedagogy of Tanakh study in most of the day schools and most of the Mamlachti Dati and other schools in Israel in order to engage much more in active learning, where students are, as muf'al, as they say in Hebrew, where they are activated rather than simply passive learners. And this was a tremendous contribution to the world of pedagogy of Tanakh. Unfortunately, many teachers did not do that, but many did and adopted that as the methodology. And she saw, as her pedagogic goals, there were four pedagogic goals that Nechama would often articulate in her teaching. One, in ascending order. One was teaching of skills rather than yeda. She believed in teaching a havana rather than yeda, as Kashi, as she famously used to say, v'chol mikre heim lo zochrim shum davar. Nobody's going to remember anything anyway. 2 weeks later. So teach them skills rather than teach them anything else. Number one. Number two, she believed that the ultimate goal of teaching was ahavat Torah, get them to love Torah. And number three, shmirat ha-mitzvot. The ultimate goal, especially with religious kids, is to shmirat ha-mitzvot. Unfortunately, she said, that's not always so possible in the context of a classroom because you don't have a living laboratory, you're not at home. And therefore, she often would say that the focus should be on ahavat Torah, and therefore, she hated the word chomer. She hated the word tzrichim la'aspik chomer. You have to finish the material. She hated that terminology because for her, the question wasn't how much you covered in a semester, but whether the kids have been engaged, whether the kids were, did they have ahavat Torah, etc., etc. And therefore, she believed, as I said, very strongly in anything that would engage students. And so therefore, for example, one of her very important methodological pushes, which drove many in the Haredi world crazy, was, and I can tell you from firsthand knowledge, I remember, was the idea that students should be asked not only to compare and contrast Mefarshim, but to personally express why, which one is more correct or less correct, based on their analysis of the text, which has a strength and which has a weakness. I remember about 15 years ago, I was asked to speak on Christmas in New York City, not at the church, but in shuls in New York. They often have learning programs on Christmas because people are off. I don't know what they do in Canada, so Rabbi Kelman does something. So they have learning programs. So I was asked to give a learning program different methodologies of Tanakh. So they had myself and a wonderful Haredi woman who runs one of these Jewish Renaissance Center kind of things. And so we were both asked to give a shiur on Perek Aleph of Bereishit, which is I'm going to be giving later today. And so she gave her shiur and I gave my shiur. And we were supposed to talk about also methodology. So I gave methodology and I talked to her. And the one thing that drove her up a wall was when I talked about that if you teach this in class and you're teaching the first pasuk of Bereishit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim, there's a big machloket in the parshanut. How should you read it? Is it a subordinate clause? And it's really Bereishit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim et ha-aretz va'aretz hayta tovu v'hu vayehi or that the main clause is vayehi or. And I said, you have to get the kids, put it on the board, and get them fighting in the class. Which one is right? Why is it right? Ooh, did she take off on me? How can you ask kids in 11th grade to decide whether Rashi is right or Ramban is right? And, it was like two different worlds. Because it wasn't a question of judging that, God forbid, some 11th grade kid in SAR is smarter than Rashi. That's not the issue. The issue is, how do you engage kids with text? And how does it speak to you? And whether they say it or they don't, something makes more sense, something makes less sense. And get them involved and learn. But, so that was something that was very important to Nechama. So, and therefore, for her, it was important not simply to say over a Rashi or say over a Medrash, but you have to get the kids active in trying to figure out what was bothering the parshan, what was bothering the midrash in the text. And so this became a central part of her methodology. Ma kashel Ramban, ma kashel Rashi, what is difficult in the text? And therefore, to go beyond simply parroting what's in the text. So these are, in very much, in really very short terms, some of the wonderful contributions, in addition to the fact that she was probably one of the greatest marbitzei Torah, one of the greatest, marbitzei Torah, one of the greatest teachers of Torah and spreaders of Torah in the last century, in terms of how many people who didn't have access before the internet to learning Torah and couldn't get to a shiur, and yet, were able to learn something b'chavruta, b'chabura, or with other people. And she elevated the status of Torah teaching to a great extent. She was the great teacher, the great morah, and a tremendous pedagogue, and taught a whole generation or two or three of teachers how to teach Tanakh in many ways, similar to as Rabbi Salvechik in the area of teaching Gemara to many, many people. And many Nechama was really a master in that way. So after that introduction, I'd like to spend the next few minutes engaging in a loving critique after 20 years, 25 years of being in the classroom, using Nechama's methodology, and seeing some of the strengths and weaknesses. Now, some of the critiques apply to what I would call an exaggeration of Nechama, Nechama on steroids, that some teachers basically took the shita and became so monochromatic and so rigid. And anytime you become rigid, like a brisker, if you're only going to learn the Gemara and think every Gemara is going to be understood with the brisker method, and there's nothing else to gain from other types of learning, you end up with a kind of distortion. And one of the things that happened and happens in some classrooms that are Nechama and nothing else is that the study of Tanakh, which should be, and Nechama insisted, should be the focus. The text should be the focus. Unfortunately, in some classrooms I've seen, the Parshan takes the place of the text, of the Dvar Hashem, of the words of the text. And so a 40-minute period can be spent on Makashel Rashi instead of the kid learning the story of whatever it is, of Shechem, or learning the story of Yaakov getting married to, you know, you spend an entire class into Makashel Rashi, or becomes a seminar in Parshanut rather than focusing on the text. And one of the things, unfortunately, that some of the people who took Nechama's method to an extreme was that the entire class became a seminar in Parshanut, and the text slowly disappeared in the context of the discussion. And that, I think, is something that is very tragic and something that Nechama herself would have been very critical of. But in a certain sense, she created the Frankenstein that came and overtook many classrooms that I've sat in. Number two, because of that, yeah. It's a corruption of, but I said the words, it was those who took her approach to an extreme. But the nitzanim, the seeds of that corruption are also in her books and in her Gilyonot and in her method of teaching. Meaning, of course Nechama didn't want that to happen. But in some of her teaching methodology and emphases, it became so much a focus, and that's what she felt needed to be explicated, that sometimes it became overburdensome. Which leads me to my second point. My second point is that because of Nechama's love for... Well, let me say something before my second point. In addition to the fact that sometimes it became too much of a seminar on Parshanut and the text was eclipsed, something else happened in the focus on Parshanut. One of the beauties of Parshanut is that it really focuses on the detail. And it focuses on the micro issue. That's the nature of biblical exegesis. That's the way the Rishonim thought. They thought in those categories. They thought in categories, most of them, except for a few exceptions, most of them did not think in big picture terms of an entire sefer or an entire narrative. Even that terminology, the very modern terminology, the Joseph narrative. Most of them thought in very concrete terms of this pasuk, this phrase, this. Now, the more you focus on classical Parshanut, the less you develop a sense of a broad picture of kind of the major questions of a book, which is a very kind of modern conception. What is the purpose of Sefer Shmuel?
That's the kind of question Nechama never asked in a shir. That's not what she thought, that this was kind of too vague. What is the literary structure of the entire Sefer? How do you divide this book in its entirety? What is the chiastic structure of a perek? Now, once in a while, she did that. But this wasn't the major focus of her study, nor of the study of Parshanut. The more you're rooted in classical Parshanut, the less you're going to deal with these macro questions. And you're going to be much more focused on micro questions. The one exception, from time to time, the Ramban, sometimes at the beginning of a Sefer, has a little bit of the macro. And the Abarbanel sometimes has a little bit of the macro. But the kind of sustained macro questions that people like Rav Yoel Bin Nun and Rav Mordechai Breuer and people of that ilk ask, the Dat Mikra kind of series, where you have a broader questions, what are the theological goals of this book? What are the purposes of this book? How do you divide the book? The kind of major questions, structural, literary questions, as opposed to just the literary issue of this pasuk, those kinds of things Nechama did not focus on, and it wasn't her interest. And one of the interesting things is, as the 70s and 80s progressed, it's very interesting, more and more Israelis became more and more interested in that kind of stuff than in Nechama stuff. That's the reality. By the mid-70s and 80s, Nechama was not as popular with Israelis as she was with Americans. Mi besari echze. I remember going to her house in the mid-80s when I took shiurim with her, and she gave shiurim at home, and she gave shiurim for seminars. Most of her students by the mid-80s were either Americans or American Israelis. They were not, very few Israelis were still coming to her shiurim. Israelis had moved on to study Rav Yoel Bin Nun and Rav Mordechai Breuer and that kind of methodology, what we call the literary theological methodology that focuses on the big questions, on big issues, and how to divide a perek, how to divide a pasuk, a narrative, how to see a narrative in the context of a whole sefer, big, broad themes. These became major issues that Nechama was not as interested in. And in certain ways, I feel that I think a total understanding of Tanakh requires both. And it was, to me, as I got older and I read other things, it was a little bit of a chisaron, because I felt that there were many issues, meta issues, that needed to be confronted, meta literary structures that gave insight into Tanakh, and many other things that we, by focusing so much, trying to teach us so much on the micro level, we ignored some of the macro questions that give Tanakh its ma'of, give its vision and its grandeur, I think especially as we understand it today. And that also ties in, because Nechama was so wedded legitimately, because as traditional Jews, we all are, it's very hard for us to disconnect from Parshanut. Sometimes we're so rushing to the Parshanut, we didn't let the text speak for itself. We were so running to find out, to compare the Malbim and Rashi and the Ramban and Kasuto, and that we didn't let the text speak for itself, which is another wonderful byproduct of what's called the new methodology. It's not so new anymore. The Rav Yoel Bin Nun and the Mordechai Breuers and Menachem Liebtag and all those students of those people, all that allows the text, before you run to the Parshanut, to let the text hit you. Nechama herself believed in that. She often would say, you have to learn the Chumash like Rashi did, without Rashi, which was a cute line. But very often, it was more in the breach than in the reality. It wasn't, in the reality, we were running to Rashi, and we didn't let the text fully speak to us without, you know, first letting the text speak before running to the Parshanut. Two other areas that one can raise a valid critique about the methodology of Nechama, Zichrono Livracha, was, to a large extent,
Because she was such a didactic personality, and a personality who was steeped in ethics. Anybody that reads her Gilyon note and her every other Gilyon has some sort of moral point, right? She's very didactic. Because she was a teacher, and she felt very strongly that almost every lesson has to have a point, has to have a musar about ethics, about relationship to God, about relationship to Am Yisrael, about, right? You read the Gilyon note, it's very, you know, some might say it's heavy-handed, but it's very direct, the didactic point. Because of that, she, to a great extent, was not really into what we would call today realia. She wasn't really interested in, you know, and the Jews went derech eretz plishtim. You know, what was derech eretz plishtim in the real sense? What was it? Who cares? She didn't say it in that way, but ultimately, sometimes she did. You know, who cares? Who cares whether it was here or whether it was there? If it has a message for me today, it doesn't really matter. She was not really interested that much. Occasionally she quoted it, but it was more parperet than something that she wasn't really interested so much in archaeological studies. She wasn't really interested that much in anthropological studies of the ancient Near East. She wasn't really interested that much in historical material. Now, one of the interesting things about, at least to me, about religious people who are also Bible scholars, like Uriel Simon, or Rav Yoel Ben Nun, or others, is their attempt to integrate the best of the archaeological, historical, anthropological studies to shed light on so many interesting stories in Tanakh that give us a richer depth. It may not always give us the kind of didactic musari goal that one might want to achieve in a classroom, but often it does give us greater depth to get to the emet of what's going on, and in an ultimate sense, I think it will achieve a greater understanding of the theology of the Bible, the purpose of the Bible, the goals of the Bible, and the polemics of the Bible in a deep way that ultimately do enhance Yirat Shamayim and our connection to Tanakh. And finally, one of the critiques, this I'm not as sure of, but one of the critiques that have been heard in Israel, especially, and then I'll, no, actually the second, the penultimate, one of the critiques, if you talk to Israeli kids who took the Bagruyot in the 80s and 90s, Nechama's approach ended up dominating because most of her students became the mucky-mucks in Misrad HaChinuch, in the Ministry of Education, and became the mifakhim, and right? And so they wrote the tests. And what happened, again, was a kind of distortion, if you want to use that term, of her method. Nechama would, as I said, all over and over again, would emphasize that Bikiyut B'Tanach wasn't really important. Yeda is overrated. It's Havana, understanding. And so a lot of the tests in the late 60s and 70s in Israel became very heavily focused on skills, including a lot of what's called unseen, things that the kids had never seen, which on one level is excellent to apply your skills, but it also became very rote in some ways. Makashel Rashi, Makashel Ramban, Makashel, and it became not exactly what she wanted. There was a lot of critique in the late 80s and 90s about this, that some people said there needs to be a balance drawn between Yeda and Havana, number one. Number two, it's not true that people forget everything they learn. People remember, as Rav Yoel used to say, thousands of songs. How come people know every song they learned or every tune from when they were kids from a television show? Because it's the way that you teach things. If you're mishanein in a certain way, and so the idea that you never remember anything is not true. It depends what you learn, how you learn, in what context, and how you bring it to the fore with Te'ameha Mikra, and the whole thing. So this is another question. The final issue, Nechama, as a very committed Jew full of Yirat Shamayim, was unalterably opposed to biblical criticism. And she believed that it was, as she said, she liked to quote Solomon Schechter, it was biblical, it was higher anti-Semitism, not higher biblical criticism. That was one of her favorite lines. And to a great extent, she was still very much rooted in the biblical criticism she had encountered in Germany in the 20s and 30s when she went to university. And to a great extent, she was right that there was many, many anti-Semitic undertones to early biblical criticism of Graf Wellhausen and etc. But the truth is that, you know, the world continues. And to simply make believe like the challenges of biblical criticism don't exist, I think is to do a disservice to our students, to ourselves, to the study of Tanakh. And the idea of engaging it head on, which was something Rav Mordechai Breuer and others did, I think is something that continues to be a challenge for us in the modern Orthodox world. And the idea that we can simply poo-poo it and not engage it, or at least study it to understand where it's coming from, the questions that it asks. Some of the questions that it asks are really important questions. And how we address it, I think, becomes educationally and ultimately, from a Yirat Shamayim point of view, a very important endeavor. And so I think that with all of her passion and all of her commitment to never talking, she never talked in her Gilyon note about biblical, never engaged it, I think that can't stand the test of time. If we want to create a modern Orthodox methodology of studying Tanakh that will last for the next 200-300 years, I think what we need to do is continue to take the best of Nechama. I love learning her Gilyon note. I love going back to read portions that I read when I was a kid. I still am very much enamored with so many things I learned from her. I still remember her stubbornness, which is, she was stark as they can be. She was not to be trifled with in any way, shape, or form. She was a super tzioni, as we all know. She never left the State of Israel after she made Aliyah, even though she was offered a lot of money to speak at the Y and other places. And she was insistent on Ivrit, which is amazing, in the sense that I'm talking about her in English, and I'm sure she'd be mortified, but the world continues. There are very few people like that. She came from a world of religious Zionism, which was, kind of a world where the collectivist ethos was so, she was so committed to the collectivist ethos of the Jewish people rebuilding and being reborn in its home, something that is, the individualistic ethic that took over the State of Israel and general the world in the 80s and 90s was not her thing. She really didn't fit into that. And, it should only be an Ilui Neshama, all the learning and teaching that she did. But I also, as I said at the beginning, we have to be Talmidim and not simply Hasidim, and also ask questions about methodology, just like we have to ask questions about the methodology of Rabbi Soloveitchik or anybody else that we adore and that we pride ourselves as being students of. What is the relevance? What are the strengths? What are the weaknesses? In order to continue to be learning from the person and not simply putting them on a pedestal. That's what I wanted to share this morning. And if anyone has a question that they'd like to ask or comment, I'm certainly open. Yeah. It's for posterity.
Whoa. I was going to ask about the Bible criticism. In the 30s, you have all these gedolim in the Bible, and I include Ben-Gurion.
Right.
He loved to quote the German Bible critics. So did Yecheskel Kaufman.
Right. But Yecheskel Kaufman wasn't he tried to show the weakness of many of their theories.
Right, but he knew them. Right. And I wanted to ask you, did she know the Bible critics? And if you know something, involuntarily comes into the teaching. And same way you mentioned Breuer, you mentioned Binun, Saunas, putting the Bible in Mid-Eastern context. Did she know about it? She have anything?
Right. So,
did it sort of by osmosis?
So I can only give you my sense from hearing her and reading her. She made comments from time to time. I don't think she had a very strong background in biblical criticism. I think she took a course in university in Germany where she was exposed, like a survey course. Like we today, you go survey, and she was very turned off to it. She did not spend her days and nights reading Bible criticism. That's not what she did. I think her exposure was, an exposure like every kind of intelligently trained student in Germany would have been exposed to, number one. Number two, she read, however, all of the Jewish people who responded to biblical criticism. So she had it through Klishlishi. So she, Hoffman, Kasuto, Benno Jacob. Now these people, they were Bekiim in Bible criticism of the time. They read everything. And whatever they chose to present and schlug up to respond to, she knew. So that she knew. But she was not an expert. And she never claimed to be an expert. She was not interested in it. And therefore, she didn't read. You know, her knowledge of Bible criticism was kind of stuck in the 30s. And what the people like Hoffman, who was in the 10s, and Kasuto in the 30s, and Benno Jacob in the 20s and 30s wrote, she did not read what people, you know, were writing in the 40s and 50s and 60s. She wasn't interested in that. She didn't read that much. She read some of it.
May have been a student, but
She did not read so much of that. From time to time, she would read. When Breuer came out with his first essay in 1960, she bitterly attacked it. She was so opposed to it. And they had a long-running feud over the next 35 years about lots of things. And in one of his biographical essays, he recounts a conversation that he had with her about, you know, his methodology. Again, it's very hard to say it in one sentence, but fundamentally, he accepted the methodology of biblical criticism, but he believed, meaning that there really were contradictions in the Bible. He was not a harmonist. And that really there are different sources in the Bible. The only thing is, those sources all come from Hashem. All those sources are there from Hashem. So he once had a conversation. Nechama, Zichron Ali Vracha, adored Rabbi Soloveitchik. That was the rabbi. There were a couple of rabbis she loved. Rabbi Arya Levin. She had a picture of Rabbi Arya Levin, the Tzaddik of Yerushalayim, on her desk. Rav Kook and Rav Soloveitchik. And she was very enamored with the essay, The Lonely Man of Faith, which talks about the two typologies of chapter 1 and chapter 2. In her original Gilyo note, it hadn't yet come out, so she didn't know it. And even when she published the book, she just has a footnote. The essay of Rabbi Soloveitchik just came out, but I can't incorporate it in this Gilayon about Tzelem Elokim and Zachar and Nekeva. Fine. So she never really engaged it. But she loved that essay. And she told Breuer, this is, you know, a wonderful approach of dealing with chapter 1 of Genesis and chapter 2 of Genesis. So Breuer said, but don't you understand? This is ultimately what I'm trying to do in all of Tanakh. That there are different perspectives on truth. That the same incident, story, etc. can be presented by God from two totally contradictory points of view. And she wouldn't hear it. She said, yeah. So he writes about how basically she was willing to accept something from Rav Soloveitchik, because if Rav Soloveitchik says it, it must be okay, but she didn't transfer it beyond that. So he's very harsh in that essay. It doesn't matter. But she did not continue to read everything. I mean, she read a lot, but she read like most of us. Most of us like to read the things that we're interested in. And so she read a lot of things, you know, a lot of people, a lot of her students did a lot of work on Parshanim. So she read, you know, she read Sarah Kamin's work on Rashi and Tawito's work on Rashbam and other things. But this wasn't something, beyond that, she wasn't really so interested in all of the stuff that people were writing and developing. She read some of it, and she, at least according to some people, towards the end of her life, she started to say, maybe, there were things that I was too obstinate about. And maybe there's some truth in some other methodologies. But she was very... And there was one thing I forgot, so let me just add in this context. One thing that I definitely found, I wish Nechama had done more of. Nechama was very much believed, couple of kind of animamins. One of her animamins was that Rashi never says anything unless he has a koshi, right? Makash shel Rashi. And if Rashi has three perushim, it's because the first perush has a problem that only the second perush can address, or the third, meaning each one has a... Rashi never just quotes anything for the sake of quoting something, number one. That's what Nechama believed, B'lev Nefesh. She wrote a whole essay about it. Number two, she was not very into historical study of the Parshanim. Once in a while, she would mention, like the Abarbanel, talking about, Migdal Bavel, that this was affected by his encounter with, the court of Spain and civilization, right? But she rarely did it beyond the Achronim. Once in a while, like Hirsch was affected by Torah Derech Eretz or with the Reform. But when it came to Rishonim, she was very much like this was pristine. The Rishonim are never motivated by anything except exegetical concerns. One of the things we know today, after the study of Parshanut in depth by historians like Professor Toshma, Zichrono Livracha, Professor Grossman, may he live and be well in Israel, Professor Tawito on the Rashbam, Sara Kamin, and many others, is that we know that they also were affected by the historical reality against them, whether it was polemics with Christians, whether it was polemics with Karaites, whether it was going through the Crusades, and many other things. Sometimes explicitly, like when the Bechor Shor says, Ulechuvat Haminim, in response to the Christians, and sometimes not so explicitly. This was something, an area that Nechama did not explore at all, and I think it was a loss, because I think in many places we understand better some of the motivations of the Parshanim when we put them in the proper historical context. And this was not something that she was into. And number two, we now know today from the academic study, let's say, of Rashi. Rashi, we have 200 and 300 manuscripts of Rashi in the Hebrew University Library. And we know that a lot of things in our Girsa Ot of Rashi were added by students. So some of the lumdus that people make about this or that Rashi is not true. It really was a Talmud who decided to add a little vort, or liked the Medrash and decided to quote it, number one. Number two, most scholars today of Rashi, the real Gedolim in Rashi, do not accept the theory that every single Rashi, even the stuff that's really Rashi and not Rav Shmaya and not the Talmidim of Rashi, is always because of an exegetical koshi. There are things in Rashi that may be driven by ethical messages he wants to convey, moral messages, or simply that was what you first started when you read the Pasuk, and then you go on to other things. It's like when I was in Breuer's once, many, many years ago, somebody got up at a bris to give a Dvar Torah. So the guy wanted to say a Dvar Torah, but he felt he can't get up and not quote Rav Hirsch. So first he says, Rabbiner Hirsch says blah, 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 blah. And then he says, but I'd like to say something else. It was like, like paying lip service. So that's another area that needs to be explored further. So thank you for your question. Yes, sir.
Take it from what you just said previously, was that she didn't, her expertise didn't extend to the proper girsa of Rashi.
Correct. She herself, the World Zionist Organization, the Torah Department, Olav HaShalom, once asked her if she would be willing to write a commentary on Tanakh in the late 70s. And she said, V'vatay shalo, ani lo mumchit. She said, I have to spend years studying philology, archaeology, history. I mean, she was a very,
She understood where her koach was, and she said, if you want to write a real commentary, you need to have all these other disciplines at your fingertips. She felt she was doing what she was doing. Okay, thank you very much for your hakshava and your involvement, and have a wonderful day.